I didn't want to give up so many times because I'm like, this is just ridiculous. I see other people getting published left and right. And why isn't it my turn? When is my turn going to come?
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Kim Coleman Foote, author of the biomythography novel, Coleman Hill. It's a story Kim culled from her collective family memory to understand the origin point of abuse, not just in her family, but within the Black community writ large.
Are they evil or are their actions evil? And where did that come from? It came from somewhere. And if we don't look at that history, we don't understand how we fix that and stop that, right? So it's like, again, this is psychology. It's behavior. Where are the roots of that behavior coming from?
Kim's journey to telling her family story is one that began as she was working on another novel. How her personal interest in the early 2000s contributed to her literary debut some 20 years later. Plus, how she got over her own jealousy of other writers whose books were coming out before her. And after querying agents since she was like 12, Kim explains what it feels like to hit the home run of her dreams. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. Kim, when did you know that you were a writer?
Oh, I've known since I was a little girl growing up in Jersey. I basically wrote my first story when I was about 7 years old, and it's continued since then.
Was writing always encouraged in your family, or was that something that you found your way back to as you got older?
No one in my family was a writer, but we had lots of storytellers. So I heard stories from my family since I was a little girl. And I guess just hearing those stories, my brother and I also used to do drawings together. We used to make up little stories. And so when I wrote the first story, I was like, oh, this is cool. And so I just kept going from there. In fact, at some point, I wanted to be the youngest person to publish a book, a novel in this country. And so I first queried an agent when I was about 12 years old.
Wow. I have never met anyone who was so committed, so young. So yes. I just want to know, what was that like querying an agent at 12?
I had so much confidence in my writing and my abilities because, like I said, I would share my little drawings and stories with my classmates, even in elementary school. And I remember, you know, it would just be like, people be so excited. Oh, let me see, lining up, you know, to read or look at my things. And so, you know, I guess like getting the attention was encouraging. But then also like hearing from teachers, you know, who kept telling me, oh, you have a vivid imagination, you have a way with words, you know, so having, and my mother, you know, would always say like, oh, writing is your gift, telling stories is your gift that no one can take away from you. So I always just kept that to heart. And, you know, I wanted to be that person who was telling these stories and entertaining people in the beginning, you know, when I was young. But then as I got older, like when I went into college, it was more about educating. I was learning, you know, these little known facts about Black history, taking Black studies courses, for example, and just, you know, learning so much about Juneteenth, female Tulsa. And so I wanted to get that information out to people as well.
So then how did your storytelling and love for history carry you as you moved from college and became older and started working in the world?
Well, I think it was always present. I was always fascinated with history, again, since I was a little girl, because I heard those stories about my mother and her cousins would talk about growing up their life in like the 1940s. I grew up in the 80s. So the 1940s was very different, right? and my parents were old school. So like they still call the refrigerator the icebox, right? I always had that word and all these old timey words in my vocabulary since I was a kid, because my parents, you know, still use a lot of those terms. So I was just always, again, fascinated with like other times, the past. There's also like certain people in my family who I consider like the keepers of memory and history and family stories. And so I'm also an inheritor of that because I had like my mother and then certain aunts, you know, who would like always tell the stories. This is where we came from. This is the names of our ancestors, and repeating these stories because they thought it was worthwhile to remember. And so for me, it was just like passing the torch or carrying the torch along.
So then when did the idea come to you to say, you know what? All these stories that have been shared with me in my family, I want to put them in a book.
So the first instance of this book actually came out when I was in my MFA program in Chicago at Chicago State University. And I had an assignment, was actually for a creative nonfiction class, to write a story based off of a photograph. And I chose a photo of my grandfather's three sisters as little girls. I don't know how I chose it, but that's the one I had. And I had been wanting to write about my family for a long time. I didn't know if it would be fiction, if it would be nonfiction, because there were so many interesting stories, a lot of trauma and unprocessed trauma in my family, even to this generation, you know? And so when I had that photograph, all of a sudden, the little girl's voice just spoke to me. And she said, "I ain't afraid of that man or his camera." And I was like, "What?" And the words just kept pouring, you know. And usually for me, you know, when I write fiction, I don't hear words. You know, I have a lot of friends who are poets and they always talk about the word coming to them. I see movies in my head, you know. So the fact that I was getting these words and it was coming from this little girl, and then they just kept pouring. And so I rushed to write them down, and the whole thing came out in like minutes. And I was like, whoa, this was interesting, because this was also a person in my family. You know, she was villainized. No one ever had a good word for her. She was, you know, mean. She was drunk. She was nasty. She was evil, you know. And so here is this little girl talking about her experience and something traumatic that happened to her. Right. And this is why she looks even defiant and, quote, evil in this picture at such a young age. And I just had a lot of empathy for her, right? And I was like, oh, maybe this is why she was like that as an adult. And I felt like that was kind of like my spiritual permission to keep going, you know, because it's like, okay, you can do this. And so I started taking other family photographs and trying to like build stories around them, because, you know, some of the people in my family, I only knew like very basic things about. Like, one of my great grandfathers died of lockjaw. That's really all I knew. He died of lockjaw. He worked in construction. He was helping build a movie house, and he got cut on a rusty nail or pipe or something like that. That's all I knew. And so he was one of the first relatives that I actually found on the census when I started doing my genealogical research, which was not for the book. That was just my complete hobby. And I didn't even know, I didn't even think I would find my family in the records. But when I started doing my research at the National Archives in DC, I found them. And I was just in awe, like, oh my God, these poor farming, sharecropping people, you know, who went to school to the third grade, you know, could not read and write. They're the children of slaves, all this kind of stuff. But they're here in these records, you know. And so I just kept searching and finding so much records. So by the time I realized that I wanted to write a book, I had all that genealogical information. I'd also interviewed relatives to get, you know, more information, but that was, again, for my personal interest. But once I was writing the book, I had that material to build off of, just to give me some more details to go on.
How long between the time that you wrote that first story in your MFA program to when you really, like, dove deep into the process of writing the novel? What was that time frame like when you were doing all this research just on your own?
So it's a long time frame. I started the research around 2000, the genealogical research, right? But the first instance of it, that story with the little girl's voice, came in 2004. Because in between then, I was working on a whole other novel, which my publisher is publishing next. But, you know, that novel had already even been in the works before 2000. So I was working on that in my MFA program. My thesis was actually a memoir. So I spent a lot of time in Ghana because my next novel was set there, looking at the slave trade in the 18th century. And so I also did a Fulbright fellowship, and I was there for like almost a year doing research, interviewing people, kind of a lot of the same things that I did with my family history. But basically 2010 was when I finished my Ghana novel about the slave trade. And so I had a residency in Vermont. And so at that point, I was like, okay, I'm done with this book. I'm going to move on to, it wasn't even a book. I didn't think of Coleman Hill as a book. You know, I was just like, I'm just writing these stories about my family and just getting them down on paper because they're so fascinating and powerful. I want to share them. And so it wasn't until I read Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kitteridge and I was like, oh, so my great grandmother is like Olive in the sense that in that novel, Olive, I think, gets maybe like one chapter from her perspective. Everything else is other people, you know, but even though she might not even be there, you feel her presence. It's like a black hole that like sucks in everything and everything revolves around her. And I realized that my great grandmother was the person in my family who was doing that. And so once I figured that out, I was like, oh, now I see the possibility for an actual book. And so I had, you know, been thinking of different threads in my family, interesting like historical details. And some of those things dropped out because it didn't relate to that central theme. So that's when it kind of all came together. But I can't even remember what year that was because I was working on so many other things, you know. So this Coleman Hill was like kind of my Johnny come lately surprise.
Yeah. I mean, well, even saying, you know, you wrote the first story for your MFA program when you thought you were focusing on memoir 2004, 2005-ish. It's now almost 20 years later.
Yes.
That this book is coming out. So how does that feel? And what has your publishing process been like?
I mean, from someone who wanted to publish a book when they were 12, right?
That part.
It's been a long, rocky road, you know, and it's been frustrating. It's been, definitely been frustrating. It's been so many years of just like grueling labor, you know, not only the writing itself, which can be grueling, but also just the process of, you know, querying agents and querying publishers. I always believed in my writing. I believed in myself. I believed in my stories. And that's what kept me going, you know, and other people also believing in me, you know, like I would have people who, you know, hadn't seen me in 10 plus years and we would like run into each other. Oh, you're still writing. Oh, thank God you're still writing because I always knew you would blah, 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 you know? And so like having those people like give me that boost of confidence because I didn't want to give up so many times because I'm like, this is just ridiculous. I see other people, you know, getting published left and right. And why isn't it my turn? When is my turn going to come? And so, you know, and then I was winning a lot of like fellowships and awards, recognizing my work, even since my memoir. And just thinking again, like I'm winning all this stuff. People are recognizing my talent. They're recognizing the writing, the stories, the characters. Give me these amazing gushing notes, but when is someone going to say, finally, I want to publish you? And so basically it happened so quickly. What had happened, it happened like so quickly that I'm still kind of like processing it because my book deal basically went down a little bit over a year ago. And so, and my publisher, like I said, they bought both of my novels. Which was like the dream.
So Coleman, you know, Hill, but, in the novel in Ghana?
Yes, my Ghana novel as well, which is slated to come out in 2025 if I, you know, get it done on time. Let's hope. So it's kind of surreal. Like I'm super excited, but it's also surreal because it's been so many years, you know, wanting this thing. I describe it like, you know, when you have that dream and it's like, I won the lotto and you have all the money in your hand and you can feel it like, oh my God, oh my God. And then you wake up and it's like, oh man, it was just a dream, you know, but this is like, no, it's actually real. It actually did finally happen.
How did you motivate yourself to keep going despite the discouragement?
I actually had to stop going to readings. Unless it was a dear, dear friend of mine who was publishing a book, because a lot of my friends did publish their books along the way. I stopped going to readings. I stopped going to bookstores as much as I am a book addict. I just kind of took myself out of that world because I had so much jealousy, honestly. And I was like, this jealousy is not productive for me to write, you know, because ultimately I have to just keep on writing, producing, improving my game. So I just basically like removed myself from that world, kind of really staying out of the mix and just keeping my head down. I was like, the only thing that you can control is what you put out. Mm-hmm. You can't control who's going to publish you, who's going to want to publish you, any of that stuff. So I focused on what I could control. And I just kept coming back to, you know, I had to ask myself constantly, like, why are you doing this? Why are you writing all this? And it was like, okay, I'm committed to telling the story, right? And so at some point I had to tell myself, like, you know, even if no one is going to publish me, I'm committed to telling these stories. And, you know, that's ultimately what got me through, just refocusing.
I mean, you say your deal went down a year ago and now your book is out. So like that is very, very quickly for publishing. But then also you're publishing through Zando, through the Sarah Jessica Parker imprint.
Yes.
Carrie Bradshaw herself. So what has it been like to go from, you know, these years of toiling, having to take yourself out of, you know, the mix of the book world to now having a debut with such great fanfare and celebrity support?
I've always dreamt big, like, oh, if I could have my way, it would be this and this and this. But like I said, I just started to like, yeah, it's probably not going to happen. So again, as long as I get a book out, you know, I'll be satisfied. That was like what I was working on when I even got my agent. And even that process happened so quickly with this book, whereas I have been searching for an agent since I got my MFA in 2005. And it happened like lightning speed. And I have an amazing agent also. I have an amazing editor, you know. Sarah Jessica Parker has been like just, again, amazing, amazing, amazing. It's been like a dream come true and beyond wildest dreams, I tell people. But I always had an image of myself like hitting a baseball out of the ballpark, you know, because I was like, all these years, I work so hard. You know, when it comes, I better like hit the homer. And I was just like, oh, I hit the homer. And it just like every step of the way, it was like, oh, I got the eight. Oh, I hit that homer. Ooh, hoo, hoo. And then the book deal. Oh, I hit another homer. And so it was just like, oh my God, that visualization is finally, you know, coming to fruition. So yeah, I was literally so, so close to giving up, but just continued holding that vision.
Yeah, I have one more question before we get to the book.
Yes.
You say like people were pestering you to finish the family book. I assume though that was members of your family, but
no.
Really?
No.
Oh, okay. But I was wondering, since you were writing like, you know, these ancestral stories, and I think you talk in the acknowledgments or the author's note about, you know, like, you know, hearing the voice, you know, I ain't scared of that man or his camera.
Yes.
And then starting to hear all the other voices. Did you ever have your characters like persisting you like, hey, you should be writing our story?
No, I had that happen for my Ghana novel.
Mm.
But this, I think the ancestors are just there. They're just there with me. And so even the fact, like, not letting me give up, you know, but I didn't necessarily hear their voices. Like, he needs to write us, because I think, honestly, maybe some people don't want these stories out there. But I'm trying to represent my family with, like I said, empathy.
Mm.
And so, like, in my book, I don't consider, there's no evil person in my book, right? There are people who did evil things, but there's no evil people in this book, because I'm exploring where those evil things, those evil behaviors come from. What are the roots? And once you go to the roots, and usually that's in their childhood somewhere, you know, and you have this tender young child, something happens to them, they witness something, you know, or they experience something. And I feel like I created a rich portrait of who they are, you know, but it's not like someone was like, yeah, write about my trauma. No. No.
All right. So let's get into this rich portrait that you've created. Can you read something from Coleman Hill?
Yeah.
And then we'll dive into your family.
Sure.
Coleman Hill opens with Kim's two great-grandmothers who fled the South for Vauxhall, New Jersey. However, once they reach the North, they both lose their husbands and are left to raise their children alone. Exploring the blood ties that bind and the ones that don't, Kim chronicles the cycles of abuse that were perpetrated throughout the generations and hopes to set her family free. Here's Kim.
So I'm going to read a section from when one of my great-grandmothers sees her husband for the first time after arriving to New Jersey. The Jim you found in New Jersey wasn't the same man who left Alabama. When you got to the Pennsylvania station in Newark, you ain't recognize him until he took off his bowler hat and waved it at you and the children. Gone was the overalls, the ill-fitting gray church jacket, the unruly puff of hair like his pappy's. He wore a tailored pinstripe suit that highlighted the honey color of his eyes. The jacket was flipped open to show off a watch chain dangling from his vest pocket. His slick back hair reflected the sunlight just as much as his shoes. He leaned against a cart hitched to a horse, which he later learned he'd borrowed from his brother. You noticed colored and white ladies alike sneaking glances as they passed, and your chest puffed out. For the first time, you realized what all them girls back in Houston County, Alabama used to see in them. Just as quick, fear prickled your stomach. Suddenly, you realized you never made much of Jim's looks before, because you hoped that if you ignored them, white men might not notice Jim's effect on they women either. Then you remembered you was in the North. Couldn't nobody bother Jim. He could live a long life, unlike your ma's husband, and so could your son, Jebby. But when you got up close to Jim, the dark half moons beneath his eyes gave you pause. That night in bed, Jim held you closer than he ever done and put his nose in your hair and told you he missed that smell, how it reminded him of down home. You snickered out of discomfort and drew your head away. What, Jim? You mean to tell me you miss it back there? He sighed. I got more stuff up here, more money than I ever had. 3 suits and 3 pairs of shoes, a watch. I found us this house. I've been going to see a picture show every month, but I ain't been happy up here, Celia.
Thank you. You mentioned earlier this book has a lot of trauma in it.
Yes.
And it really does. But this line on page 75, where I believe it's the character Gra Coleman reflecting back on her parents.
Yeah.
And she says, you understood then why your ma up and deserted any man who threatened to lay hands on Johnny. It wasn't about toughening up colored boys. It was preparing them to die. And I said, my God.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of Black families are still trying to contend with what is discipline? What is
abuse?
How do we gentle parent? All of those things. And reading that line, I mean, echoes what so many people have said the family should rather beat you and put you in your place than, you know, let a white person do it, or for you to be lynched, or
you know,
preparing to walk that line. But seeing those words on the page just did something to me. So to what you were saying about there are no evil people, they are just evil deeds.
Yes.
And saying that, knowing how much abuse is in this book, how did you come to have that kind of empathy for your family? Or is it because they are your family that you have that empathy?
No.
No, that's not it.
No, I just think, like, again, like once I started to understand where these behaviors came from, and then, you know, you could say the same of white folks who committed the abuse, right? Are they evil, or are their actions evil? And where did that come from? Mm. It came from somewhere. It just doesn't pop up and like people like, oh, I'm just going to be evil and like abuse some people and enslave some people. It has a history, right? And if we don't look at that history, we don't understand how we fix that and stop that, right? So it's like, again, this is psychology. This is a lot of psychology going on, right? And even if you think, oh, well, psychology is a Western thing, it's behavior. Where are the roots of that behavior coming from? And so, again, I don't think that we can fix whatever, or like even acknowledge if we don't look at where these things came from, you know, because that whole thing about whipping, you know, like, and my old family, I grew up hearing like, I'm going to whip you. And that's just taken for granted because that's what you do. You whip someone when you get out of control, you whip them and you whip them harder and you don't cry, you know, because if you cry, I'm going to give you more. Another reason to cry about. So you learn to suck up your tears, cut off your emotions, which is just highly like unhealthy, right? But at the same time, unhealthy for you, your personal development. But then how do you survive out on the street, right? When you are confronted by a white or even an authority figure, you know, who has the instinct to gun you down just because of what you look like, right? And so I really, really wanted to interrogate those things and make it crystal clear to people like where the stuff comes from, and that we need to like really take a step back and think what we're doing, even if we consider something like cultural.
Your compassion and understanding of even white supremacy is making my teeth itch. But I do understand what you're saying in that those first colonists who came to what became the United States did so out of their own oppression.
Yes.
And then as soon as they had the opportunity, time, chance, and power to oppress others,
yes,
did so.
It was a cycle of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were recreating what had been done to them. And so the same thing that happens within families,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's the same thing that plays out in the society also.
In acknowledging the cycles of abuse that we as humans suffer under, not just Black versus white,
yeah.
or parents versus children, or given the state that we're in now between Israel and Palestine.
Yes.
How do you think is the best way to break these cycles? Because there's no real resolution at the end of Coleman Hill. It's just to tell the story, like that mandate
yeah.
that you were under is now the mandate that the characters are under.
Yeah.
But there's no end to the harms that this family, your family, all of our families have caused.
Mm-hmm. I would beg to differ, because in Coleman Hill, what I realized at a certain point is that a lot of the characters get these revelations, you know, through their journeys. They kind of have a moment where they're turning, like literally turning the mirror on themselves and saying like, oh, but wait, what does that make me? Mm-hmm. You know, what did I do? Not everybody, you know, but a lot of them have these moments where it's like, oh, I'm seeing someone in a new way. I'm seeing myself in a new way. Right. And I think it begins there. Like, it has to begin with the insight, with the knowledge of what's happening. Because if you have the blinders on, if you're continuing to deny whatever, sweeping things under the rug, that's just going to make it worse. It just keeps continuing, right? Because you're not getting again to the root of the problem. So I think the first thing is just the recognition. And my hope is that my family can read this book and realize some things that they perhaps didn't realize before, because again, there's still the blinders that are on. But, you know, even beyond my family, I'm hoping other people can look at this and say like, oh, we have that in our family. We have a person like that in our family. Oh, and this is why. So getting even some understanding about someone, as opposed to jumping quickly and saying, oh, that person's awful. This person's mean. This person's this and this and this. You know, you have so much going on, including mental illness, which people don't still talk about enough, you know, and not realizing like how a mental illness can cause someone to behave a certain way. Like, that person's crazy. That person's wild. That person's a liar. That person's whatever. But it's like, okay, this person has a legit illness, right? And so if they had some proper therapy, if they had proper medication, other interventions, their behavior could change just like night and day, potentially, right? And then you would even have this issue habit happening. And maybe for that person, if they're having a family, maybe it stops there because they got intervention, right? So I think there is hope in that sense, where someone, it's just, again, that initial enlightenment. And then beyond that, it's like the communication, right? Talking to each other and dealing with the discomfort, because with all of this history, with trauma, you have discomfort, you know, because you have someone who feels like a victim, you know, someone, the person who feels like the victimizer also has the guilt, right? But then you have the person who feels like the victim and they feel like they've been harmed, you know? And so there's uncomfortable feelings in there. You know, there's people like, well, I'm right and you're wrong. And so if we don't like get past those uncomfortable feelings, if we don't lay things out on the table, if other people can't have the empathy, you know, to step into someone else's shoes, if the victimizer can't step into the victim's shoes and say like, oh, actually, yeah, that was kind of wrong what I did, right? Or I wouldn't feel good if someone did that to me. If we don't start having those perspectives, then nothing changes. So I'm hoping ultimately even those basic things can start happening for people.
I know you said you had hopes that your family would read this book, and you say this book is based on your family. You include the family photographs. You call it a biomythography, taking
yes.
a term from Audre Lorde.
Yes.
Have you started to get feedback from your family, and what has it been? Because I am very curious.
So far, you know, it's just kind of basic feedback, just basic, like, I like liked it. I'm like, okay. And I mean, like, you know, excerpts of the book have been published over the past couple of years, and I always sent them to my family, especially if it were like, you know, featuring them or like their parents. It was more or less kind of the same, like, oh, that was interesting. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's all you got to say. Like, all right. So, you know, so far there hasn't been a whole bunch. But again, I'm hoping as it kind of like sinks in that there'll be more communication and discussion. And also like there, I have lots of cousins who don't even know a lot of these stories because of, you know, the rifts that happen in the family and people getting separated and not communicating with their parents or grandparents or whatever. And so a lot of these stories didn't get passed down to, like, I would say most of the people in my generation don't know these stories. And so for them, it's kind of like learning for the first time some of these things, you know, and obviously there's things that I've invented, you know, but there are some snippets of like truth or, you know, stories that got passed down that they haven't heard. And so, you know, for me, I welcome from my cousins to reach out to me. Like, if you ever want to know something, feel free to contact me. You know, that my mom, her cousins are still living, you know, reach out to people and talk to them and investigate more if you want to learn something.
You talked about the Ghana novel a few times, so
yes,
let's put a bow on it. What is next, Kim Coleman-Foot?
So, yes, next is Saltwater Sister. So this is my novel that I've been working on for many years, but it looks at the slave trade in West Africa. So it alternates between the 18th century, mid-1700s, and 1999. And it basically highlights women's stories of the slave trade, which you don't really hear about so much. And, you know, I started this way, way, way before Homegoing, but that's a novel that, you know, people are most familiar with to know about, like, the slave castles in West Africa, particularly Ghana. But I'm also looking at the Dutch influence in the slave trade, which a lot of people just don't know about, because here we're always focused on the British and forget that, like, so many of the European players were involved in the slave trade. And the slave trade stretched, you know, not only in this country, but this whole entire hemisphere from North America all the way down to the tip of South America and including the Caribbean. And so highlighting that's part of the slave trade as well. But I'm also looking at, you know, the European-African relations that happen in West Africa, because I originally thought that this novel would be, you know, again, kind of exploring the victim story of, like, women going through these horrors and going through the Middle Passage and then having experience here in the Americas. But then when I went to Ghana and did the research and interviewed local families in the town of Elmina, where you have the oldest and largest of these slave castles that was built, starting by the Portuguese all the way back in 1482. And this castle is still there today, standing. You know, I talked to people and I realized that there were so many fascinating stories in Elmina itself that weren't widely advertised and just stories that, like, blew my mind about, especially the relationships that happened between Europeans and Africans, because this is a time before, like, race and racism is really solidified, right? So if you read the old travelogues of the Europeans who were there at the time, you know, you can see some cultural distinctions, like the British, for example, you know, kind of had like the snotty attitude towards the Africans. It's like, okay, we're trading with them, but they're definitely below us, beneath us, and they're backwards and uncivilized and barbaric and all this kind of stuff. And then the French and the Dutch and the Portuguese were a little bit, like, you know, looser, like, yeah, but, you know, their women are fine. So, like, you know, and actually, like, this practice of having multiple wives, you know, so you had white men who were living there who were following practices where they had multiple women that they were having children with, including their official wives back in Europe, and building houses, you know, for these women, which some of the houses are still in existence today. Right. And people, if you go up and down the West Coast, you'll find so many people with European surnames, and that's way, you know, coming back from the slave trade. So really talking about that whole history, looking at the role of the royals, you know, what did they do to get the gold and the territory and all that kind of stuff? So there was slave trading going on in some of these areas. So looking at that. And then when I lived in Ghana, I basically was seeing remnants of, like, the slave trade just recreated in people's mentalities, the quote culture, you know, and I realized that there had to be a contemporary component to really talk about how history is just kind of repeating itself and could potentially get back to where it was again when people forget what happened, what came before them. So wanting to really emphasize that history as well.
Mm-hmm. So now I want to switch to a speed round and a game before I let you go for what's quickly becoming the afternoon. So okay. First question, what is your favorite book?
Oh, God, I can't even say. There's too many.
Top five.
Oh, God. Can I just say authors?
Who is your favorite author?
Octavia Butler.
Okay. What do you think is the best book to movie or TV show adaptation?
Ooh, Everything is Illuminated. I love the movie, hated the book, couldn't finish the book. And it's about, you know, this like quirky dude who's like a genealogist. I think he's Jewish, but I could so relate to him with his like family urgings and family history. And he goes to Eastern Europe to find them. So I could relate a lot to that because I've gone on the trail to find family like that.
If you could live anywhere in the world, where would it be?
Oh, the Caribbean.
Name three things on your bucket list.
I want to go to Congo. I want to skydive. And what else? I want to go to Antarctica also.
Hmm.
And I hate cold.
What brings you joy?
Music and dance in particular.
And what brings you peace?
A massage.
Mm-hmm.
Especially a massage in the Caribbean in the sun.
So our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Okay. Classic is however you define it. Name one book you wished you would have written.
Huh. That's really hard. Because again, there are so many books. Maybe Heart of Darkness.
Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
I can't even think of anything. Skip that one for now.
Okay. And then name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught and why?
Just thinking about all those books that I read back in high school. The canon, you know, which did not feature people like me. I want to say something like Catcher in the Rye.
So many people have said Catcher in the Rye this season. Hilarious. Oh my God. So many people have said Catcher in the Rye.
I hated that book. Yeah.
Yeah. So my final question for you today, when you are dead and gone and among the ancestors that you've written about, what would you like someone to say about the words and work that you've left behind for them?
Oh, wow. I would want to say that, you know, I open people's minds and help people be more understanding and kinder to each other. And heal, yes. Help people heal, yes.
Big thank you to Kim Coleman Foote for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Kim's debut novel, Coleman Hill, out now from SJP Lit, a Zando imprint. And if you're not following Kim, check her out on the socials. She's at Kim Coleman Foote on Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Kim about how she kept going when she wanted to quit, including getting a pep talk from a friend who biked from Queens to Brooklyn just to make sure she didn't give up. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be K.E. Garland, author of the memoir In Search of a Salve, Memoir of a Sex Addict.
There like came a time I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to write about sex addiction. But still, it wasn't In Search of a Salve. I was going to write it like an epistolary, like I had this diary and it was going to be called Diary of a Sex Addict, right? But it was gonna be like me confessing to my husband, like, oh, I've been trying to tell you something, but you know, here it is. But I'm like, no, this is not right. Because I hadn't kept a diary. It was kind of inauthentic. You know, you have to, you like crossing over into fiction when you do stuff like that. And I wanted it to be as real as life.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.